Members, I think what we're going to do, we do not have quorum yet, but we do have Representative Luick here, so if he wants to come to the front table, what we'll do is we'll at least get a description of what his bill does, and then once we have quorum, we'll officially call our meeting. Welcome, Representative Luick. If you could state your name for the record, and...
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Dale Luick, and I'm carrying House File 1556.
Representative Luick, I am going to stop you right there. We now have quorum. So we're officially calling the State Government Finance Committee to order. Members, in your packet, you have the minutes for March 17th. Representative Petersburg moves the minutes for March 17th. All those in favor of the minutes for March 17th, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay, so we have adopted the minutes for March 17th, 2015. And with that, Representative Luick, Representative Detmer will move your House File 1556, and you can proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill would simply move our hire a veteran month from May to July. It provides an opportunity to better coordinate with other state agencies in that process. And I do have a testifier here, Mike, from the Veterans Administration, could shed a little more light on that.
Welcome. If you can state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Mike McKelney, Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And this is an agency initiative. The desire is to simply change the Hire a Veteran Month from the month of May to July to coincide a little bit better with bigger job fairs. BEAD is a major partner with us in this, and they hold the largest job fair for veterans. The last one, they had over 145 employers and over 800 veterans there. So this we've also heard from various members that would like to be part of promoting these events as well, and citizens too. So July is just a better time for the agency and BEAD to do that.
Perfect. Members, any questions at all? Anyone from the audience wishing to speak to this bill? Seeing none, Representative Detmer renews his motion to send House File 1556 to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? All right, you are set, Representative Luick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, with that, members, we are going to have Representative Detmer present his bill. And Representative Runbeck will move House File 546 to the General Register. Representative Detmer, you want to describe your bill, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, I also have the A1 amendment.
Okay.
I'd like to get the bill in the proper form.
Representative Detmer moves the A1 amendment. Can you briefly describe your amendment?
The amendment is just a technical change of wording so that it puts the bill in the right form. And I was informed by the counties that we need to use the word veteran service in the language. Thank you.
Okay. Members, any questions to the A1 amendment? Anybody from the audience wishing to speak to the A1 amendment? Well, if not, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And we've adopted the A1 amendment, got the bill in the order that the author wishes. Representative Detmer, to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. You know, all the years that I spent in the military, I made sure when I received a copy of my orders or information that I needed to always put it in my own personal file and put it away. And certain papers, such as the DD-214, which is a record of your service, especially when you served on active duty, you put that record in my safe deposit box in the bank, actually, the original ones. And many times young soldiers or anybody might not take that course of action to put those types of papers safely away, because you need these documents to get benefits later on. And what House File 546 does, currently the law prohibits a government entity from releasing contents of the United States government, DD-214 to DD-215, or any other certificate of discharge from the military service, and unless certain conditions are met. And what this bill does, it helps sets the colonies, when you your DD-214 is registered with the colony, and many times members of the military forget which colony and where it might be located. So there's a system that's set up and that will help locate where the DD-214 is located, just like a birth certificate or a wedding certificate, a marriage certificate. And I've asked Kay Werkle to come in and describe what it will do for the counties. Thank you.
Ms. Werkle, if you can state your name for the record and who you represent, please.
My name is Kay Rookie, and I am representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers. The bill, we are creating an index for military discharge records. They're recorded, the DD-214 is generally recorded in the county of birth or where the resident or where the veteran has lived possibly the longest. And they're recorded in the recorder's office simply because it's for permanent preservation and for easy retrieval of the document. By creating an index, it is something similar to what we do with the marriage records, which are also filed in the location where the marriage is licenses purchased at, and so counties or people don't really know where they're at, so they use this index. The marriage index is used quite widely, and it is a public record, so it's open to the public to search. But the military discharge records are not, and so we are creating a private index that's only used for the VSO, the Veteran Service Officers, to get these benefits quickly for the veterans. So we've asked that this language, when we were looking at it to start the index process, we looked at the language and felt that maybe it needed a little more clarification about who can get these records. And so we worked with the VSO groups and the Minnesota VA and had some language brought together for this purpose to clarify that it is only for the use of the VSOs. It is not even used for the recorder's offices where they're recorded at. It is only for the VSOs. So, thank you.
Okay. Members, are there any questions for Ms. Werkle or for Representative, or do you have more testifiers? Okay. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill?
Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I applaud this effort because many people don't know that back, I believe it was in the 70s or so, and all of our records were sitting down in St. Louis, or we lost them all due to a fire. And a lot of the Vietnam veterans and the Korean veterans have struggled to reproduce those documents to do this. So this is a great deal. And I do believe that this will also be able to file, when you say other military forms of discharge, the NG, I believe it's an NG-22 or something to that effect, that has the National Guard discharge type forms. I believe that's the one. I'm struggling because it's not a DD-214, but it's indicates, but I would say that this is going to do the same for that and the reserves.
Welcome, and if you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. Representative Howe, you're correct in that the NGB-22 is the form. Interestingly, we don't file the NGB-22s in the counties because there is no federal veteran benefit that derives from the NGB-22. So it really won't affect that. Those are still filed in numerous locations and are available from the state in which they were generated. And members of the reserve are actually covered under the DD-214. So it will apply to members of the reserve, will not apply to members of the Guard, but those records are available through the State National Guard in the state in which they serve.
Representative Howe. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question, because I don't know, what's the difference between a DD-214 and a DD-215?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, the DD-214 is a correction to the DD-214, you know, because the federal government wouldn't want to use the same form to indicate a correction to the previous form.
So the 15 is a correction to the 14.
That's correct. The DD-215 is a corrected DD-214.
And, Madam Chair, I've never had a DD-215, so but I've made many copies of my DD-214.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, it's our federal government in its infinite wisdom.
Yes, exactly. Representative Detmer, too, all of this releasing from one government entity to another is at the request of the officer, the soldier, correct?
Mm-hmm.
The veteran, excuse me. Okay.
That's correct.
All right. Any other questions, members? If not, Representative Rumbeck renews her motion to send House File 546 to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Congratulations, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
You know, you're just dealing with veterans issues, and I just had a conversation with Representative Detmer before the meeting. My grandson, who's in the United States Marines, is driving home. He's probably here now after being stationed 18 months overseas in Japan and Korea. And he was driving home from North Carolina, and so he stopped in Kentucky. He's all by himself, and he wanted to check into a hotel. Now, he's 20 years old, been in the Marines 2 years, and they wouldn't allow him to check in because he was underage, and he had to call his mother to get permission for him to check into the hotel or motel somewhere in Kentucky. Night before last. So when I got home last night, my wife said, I said, is Cody back home yet? Because we knew he was driving up. And my wife said, you wouldn't believe what he just went through. And I just, you know, when we're talking about military things and veterans, you know, here's somebody that's literally could be called upon to put his life on his line, on the line, and can't check into a hotel because he's 20 years old. Now, I don't know whether that's a hotel policy or some law in Kentucky, but it's just an example of some things that our young veterans sometimes have to experience, and all he's doing is driving home, you know, for his leave, and runs into that kind of thing.
Madam Chair, you know,
Representative Detmer.
Representative, you know, one positive thing we can look at that is the power of the mother.
That's right.
But I think maybe we should check into what's really goes on here in Minnesota, and if there's something we need to take a look at, and maybe attach an amendment to one of our veterans bills, that maybe that's something we should be looking at.
We could maybe address it if it's a problem in Minnesota. Yeah. When you talk about the power of the mother, it's probably the advantage of cell phones, because not too long ago, sometimes it's hard to get a hold of somebody, but at least with cell phones, wherever they might be, if they happen to pick up, you can make that contact. But I just thought I'd share that story because he's 20 years old and can't even check into a hotel without mom's permission.
Are you having a party for him tonight when he gets home?
We're going to be doing something, probably not tonight, maybe this weekend or something. Okay. He's going to be here for a few, I'm not sure just how many days.
Next Monday,
he goes back to Japan.
Madam Chair. And
Representative.
Representative Carlson, if next Monday, if he's going to be in the area, if he wanted to come into our Veterans Division Committee, I would introduce him to the committee and maybe ask him to lead us in the pledge. So
okay, I can check with him, yeah. I don't know what he's planning. You know, he hasn't been home for... Yeah. Almost 2 years, so.
Are you saying this isn't the hotbed of the place you want to come? Representative Kahn.
Probably not following his father around the legislature somehow.
Well, speaking of which, Representative Nash has a guest today, if you want to introduce your guest.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Today I'm joined by my son David, who's going to stand up and wave. David is turning 16 today, and he's decided rather than go to school and have fun there, he wanted to shadow his dad here at the Capitol.
Wow. Welcome.
It's a strange and perverse idea of fun, by the way.
Well, I'm sure you'll take him out for a nice lunch. Members, we're a little off topic. To the folks that are here today, we have Ampers with us today. Mr. Glazer, if you wanted to come down and give us a presentation. Oh, there you are. Give us the presentation.
I'm working through him.
Okay. All
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I am the CEO of AMPRS, which is the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. Before I begin, I would also like to thank all of you for allowing us to make this request in person, as well as thank you for the continued support. The state has been supporting AMPRS going all the way back to 1972. AMPRS is an association rather than a radio network, and that's really the distinction between AMPRS and Minnesota Public Radio. And so what that really means to you as representatives, as well as to your constituents, rather than having one main program coming from the Twin Cities and feeding out to all of the other stations around the state, each individual station is programming their station for their specific community. AMPRS is not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio or the Twin Cities Public Television. We are the largest association of its kind in the nation. And in fact, just last week, the Greater Public, which supports public radio and public TV, recognized AMPRS as a successful example that encouraging others to follow in our footsteps. We now have a total of 17 radio stations serving Minnesota, and 16 of those 17 radio stations are eligible for state funding. One big change since the last time we were before the committee is we have two new radio stations. The first is WGZS, and that is located in Cloquet and licensed to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and KBXE serving the Bagley and Bemidji area. So we've gone from 15 to 17 stations, and 16 of the 17 stations are eligible for state funding. KUMM in Morris is not because of its size. AMPRS' role is to support the individual stations, and the station's role are to serve underserved communities. And what that really means is minority and diverse communities, rural and student communities. There are actually a total of 12 different languages on the AMPRS stations, ranging from Hmong, Somali, Oromo, Ojibwe, and more. We have a very strong focus on education, with more than 1,200, anywhere between 1,200 and 1,500 students who work within the walls of the radio stations. The students range in age from about fourth or fifth grade, may do student news at Jazz 88, all the way up to not only grad students, but non-traditional students who are in the community and want to come in and learn about radio, and there's no cost for them to do so. The stations do rely very heavily on volunteers because we are, we don't get tremendous funding because we're not allowed to run commercials. Some of them we will see as many as 300 or 350 volunteers. The stations themselves only have a staff of two. They need to have at least two full-time equivalents to be eligible for state funding. On the high end, that may go up to eight or nine, but typically they're around three or four. For comparison's sake, in commercial radio, you typically have about 40 or so people that are running the radio stations. We serve the communities in many ways. One is to provide not only timely and accurate, but very in-depth reporting on anything ranging from severe weather, emergency information. The stations work very, very closely with local emergency officials. Typically, on a radio station, if there's an emergency going on, you'll hear a 30-second or minute and a half story in their newscast. These stations are entrenched in their local communities, so they're having fire chiefs on, emergency managers on, and they'll have them on for 20 minutes, half hour, 45 minutes. If there's a wildfire going through northern Minnesota, they'll have those emergency officials on talking exactly what's going on and what the members of the community should do. Or another example would be when there was a communication breakout, a line going from Duluth was cut, and that provided all the telecommunications up to the North Shore. WTIP in Grand Marais was able to actually get on the air, have their emergency manager talking about the fact who to call because the 911 system was down, ways to communicate, and that's another great example. The stations that I mentioned do have a very strong commitment to education. Excuse me. The education programs range from on-air programs to in-studio and classroom teaching. Some of the stations, to give you an example of just how local they are, carry city council and school board meetings. Many of them also carry high school sports. That's very big for several of our news stations. The Native American stations do a lot of play-by-play. Each station has a board of directors or a community advisory committee to make sure that they are truly serving their community. Another great example of the type of community service work that we do would be KVSC in St. Cloud, which is home to the Central Minnesota Audio Newspaper. It goes out to more than 400 receivers, so that those who are unable to read, whether it be complete blindness or a vision disability, this program allows them to get access to the newspapers, with more than 40 volunteers serving that that program. We do get two different kinds of grants under the general fund. We get community service grants and equipment grants. We use the community service grants to pay electricity bills. That may not seem that sexy or that exciting. However, it's critical. It's actually one of the most expensive bills that a radio station will have. It's incredibly expensive to pay the electricity bills. So some of the stations use their community service grants for that. They will use it for tower rental fees, which is also expensive. Some put it back into employment and will pay a portion of their employees' salaries with it. It's also important to note that your state funding helps most of the radio stations to get matching federal dollars. Not all of them, but the majority of them have to have non-federal funding, and this counts towards that in order to get additional funding from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. We use the equipment grants to repair, replace aging equipment. Some cases they have to replace transmitters. There's nowhere near enough money to replace a transmitter, so this would be pooled together with other funding. Audio boards are not only failing, but the traditional audio board that you think of with little things that you pot up and down are actually no longer supported by the manufacturer. You have to migrate to digital, so we are in the process of doing that and upgrading our equipment from analog to digital. We also play a very important role in emergency services. All of the commercial and non-commercial radio stations run the emergency alert system. And the way that that works, you probably heard from Minnesota Public Radio that they are the backbone for the emergency alert system, which they are. They send a signal from their tower out to all the radio and TV stations throughout Minnesota or in that region. Currently, in the Twin Cities, there is redundancy. WCCO and Minnesota Public Radio send out those tones that the commercial or radio or TV stations receive, and then that breaks in and rebroadcasts. Outside of the Twin Cities, however, there is no redundancy. They are all on the same Minnesota Public Radio tower. The redundancy is that there is two different transmitters on the same tower, but if that tower were to be taken out by a tornado, there is no redundancy. So those emergency messages that are sent out in a data encryption would not go out to the other radio and TV stations, not just Ampers, but any radio or TV station. There is no redundancy outside of the Twin Cities. The Department of Public Safety at one point recently asked us if Ampers would have the ability to be the backup. Unfortunately, by FCC guidelines, currently we are not, because we do not have emergency generators in either at the studio or out at the transmitter. That's really the only hurdle that prevents us from doing that. So we will be asking, and I'll get to it in just a moment, an appropriation to build up that infrastructure so that we can become the backup and so that the citizens of Minnesota have more protection. As far as our actual request, Madam Chair, members, we are asking for a $275,000 equipment grant. That's an increase of $41,000 over the previous biennium. Again, the main reason for that is that we do have two new radio stations, so we ask that you look at it on a per-station basis. The appropriation does not go directly to Ampers. It goes to the Department of Administration, and then the Department of Administration does grants with each individual station. We do recommend that the appropriation to the commissioner, we recommend that they distribute it evenly. I have had members of this committee and others ask me why we would do evenly when there are larger and smaller stations. The reason for that is quite simple. The cost in running the station, whether you're up in Grand Marais or in the Twin Cities, the only real difference is the salaries. Everything else, your tower rental, your electricity, all the equipment, it all costs about the same. So we recommend that they distribute that evenly. So we are asking for a slight increase in order to bring those new stations on board. On a per station basis, that only ends up being 2.8%, and it's only a $41,000 increase. On our community service grants, we're asking for a $920,000 appropriation. That's an increase of $136,000, but again, on a per-station basis, that's only a 2.7% increase in order to bring those two new stations in. And then lastly, as I started to mention, we are looking to try and build up our infrastructure with emergency generators so that we can become the secondary outside of the Twin Cities. This funding is for the stations outside of the Twin Cities so that they can build up the infrastructure to be a backup to what is now all on one tower. With that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for allowing us to provide this presentation. And again, thank you for your continued support, and I'm available for any questions.
Mr. Glazer, we have a couple members with questions. Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, Mr. Glazer, question for you, please. Yesterday in this committee, we heard about grants being directed to agencies like yours or departments like yours having up to a 4% peel-off of that grant. I'm looking at the two that you've got, and it looks like, well, one, does that apply to you as well? Are you going to be having the Office of Grant Administration handle these? Is that going to handle? Are they going to take that off of your money? Yes or no?
Mr. Glazer.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, the Department of Administration approached us several months ago asking us to support a 4% increase. We told them that we would be more than happy to support that as long as that's above and beyond our request. That is not built into this request. So they do play an important role. We obviously govern ourselves, but it is required that it goes through the Department of Administration. They provide oversight, and so we would support that, but we would ask the committee that they do not take that out of our request.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a curious question. So you're currently administering your grants today internally. What are they going to bring to the table that you don't currently provide with your own internal resources?
Mr. Glazer.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, to clarify, the Department of Administration is currently overseeing ours because we are not a state agency. It goes through the Department of Administration. They do site inspections. They review all of our invoices. We do that internally, but they do that on behalf of the state. And out of this current grant, there is not anything that comes out of our current grant for that.
Madam Chair, last follow-up in the interest of time. So the request, similar to one we had made yesterday, is you're going to ask us to appropriate over and above an additional roughly $31,360 to cover that 4% peel-off. Is that correct?
Mr. Glazer.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, if the committee feels that it's appropriate to fund that, yes, we are asking that it be above and beyond our request because we did not, it was our understanding that they were going to be making a request on their behalf and that we would just simply be pointing out that we would support it but ask that it not come out of our appropriation.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
You said the equipment grants are evenly distributed. How about the community service grants? Is that something you apply through the Department of Administration? How does that work?
Mr. Glazer.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, my apologies if I was not clear on that. Both of those grants are distributed through the Department of Administration at the Commissioners. We make a recommendation to the Commissioner, and for both of those grants, we make a recommendation that they get distributed evenly. The only times we have broken from that is if the appropriation is so small that it does not make sense, and what we do in that case is we give half of the group year one, all of it, and then year two, the other half, so that they have enough purchasing power. But we do recommend equal distribution for both of those.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then the $880,000 appropriation for emergency service grants, where does that go, or where does that come from, first of all?
Mr. Glazer.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we are asking for that to be a one-time appropriation from the general fund from this committee. As far as what it would go to, the primary things that we need would be emergency backup generators. Both the FCC requires that in order to truly be a backup, that you have emergency backup power generators at both the transmitter site as well as the as well as the station. So we'll be purchasing backup generators for those two locations outside of the Twin Cities, because the Twin Cities has backup redundancy. And also there will be a transmitter that would need to be purchased, unless, I don't know how it will work since those transmitters exist, if we would be able to utilize the existing transmitters that are currently redundant, but only redundant in that it's if that transmitter fails, not redundant in that if the tower is taken out, that there would not be no redundancy. And I did have another member ask how many of our stations outside are not on Minnesota Public Radio, and all but 11 of our towers outside of the Twin Cities, all but one. If I said all about, my apologies there. All but one of my, all of the towers are not Minnesota Public Radio. The only area where it would, we would not be able to do that is Winona. Winona is KQAL, and they are on the same tower as Minnesota Public Radio. But all of the other Amper stations outside of the Twin Cities are not on the same tower.
Good. Thank you. And then one last question. Does that appropriation in that $880,000 from the general fund, does that go to the department administration or... Where?
Mr. Glaser?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, it's my understanding that any appropriations, including this one, would go through the Department of Administration, because it's my understanding we are not allowed to have it go directly to us because we're not a state agency. So that one, too, would go through the Department of Administration Office of Grants Management.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Howe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I got a couple of questions, and I guess as we look at distributing those equipment grants, you've got basically since 2012 five relatively new stations. What equipment, don't they have relatively new equipment? What new equipment would they be requiring if we're going to give those five new stations additional money for equipment upgrades?
Mr. Glaser.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, the best example I can give you for that is I was up at KBFT, Boysport, Net Lake, actually the Department of Administration was there for that visit, and I was shocked to find that they were actually running their radio station off of an iPad. They are using very, very minimal to get by, and so they are on the air. But they did not have automation systems. It was very rudimentary, very basic. So they are able to program it, but are certainly in need of more technology and improvements from the bare bones that they put into it in order to get on the air.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when these stations come online, you don't go out and make sure they have a basic standard equipment package when they come? It's helter-skelter. They got all different kinds of equipment. You don't have a standard package out there that says this is the minimal criteria to be one of our stations?
Mr. Glaser.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, we don't have requirements to join ours. There are requirements in order to be eligible for state funding, and we do maintain, we verify that with the Department of Administration. There are things like minimum number of FTEs, two minimum FTEs, budget minimums. There is a minimum amount of local programming that they have. However, so they are meeting the needs of the community, but they're doing so on a shoestring budget because it's very expensive to launch it. So they have the equipment that is necessary to do it. However, they are using very, very basic bare bones equipment and need to upgrade with automation systems and things like that that will allow them to serve the community even further.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would hope that maybe you put a little more oversight on what we bring online there. But the other question I have is, if we fund the generators and those emergency services grants going to fund the backup generators, I'm concerned that we're doing this a one-time grant. Where is the money going to come from? Because those generators have to be run normally if they're going to be backup. They've got to be run every month. They have to be maintained. Where's the money going to come from to maintain those backup generators in a capacity that we can rely on them to be there when we need them for an emergency? Because if they're not maintained, they're not going to be there when we need them.
Mr. Glaser.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, I certainly understand your concern on there. I can't look into the future, but what I would say is, you know, we will obviously do everything we can to fund it. However, right now it's being funded for Minnesota Public Radio in on the same tower. So you're funding it currently to have redundancy that is not truly redundant. So I would tend to reason that the rather than it all going into one that is on one tower, there would be the ability to support, because currently it is being supported. The emergency alert system is being supported with the primary and the secondary on the same tower. So we should be able to do the same thing. It just would be on a different tower. So it really should not increase costs from this committee, because it's, well, I guess, you would have a slight increase because you would have an additional transmitter that we have to be backing up, additional location. But we feel it's necessary to ensure the safety of the Minnesotans.
Representative Howe. I'm just kind of curious on the equipment grants. You said that you distribute them evenly. I am imagining that some of the equipment purchases that some of the radio stations have to make are large purchases. So then are they hanging on to that money until they save up enough to do a large purchase, or how does that work?
Yeah, Madam Chair, they are not allowed to carry it over past the life of the grant, which is typically the biennium. Yes, typically they will apply it towards other funds and pool their resources, whether it be from a grant that they get underwriting. We're not allowed to do advertising, but we can do underwriting. So they pool that money with other money in order to purchase it. Other times, though, you know, this is, as we were talking about, this is not state-of-the-art facilities. So they may be replacing duct-taped wires with real wires. That's why the wording is such that it says it, because initially, a couple years back, there was a slight change in the interpretation that it had to be major equipment. In many cases, they may be purchasing new CD players or new computers that run the automation system, but they are not allowed to pool it, but they can apply it towards larger purchases with other funding. But the money does not carry over, and that is monitored both by AMPRS and by the Department of Administration to make sure that it is being used for broadcast equipment. They aren't allowed to, you know, go out and buy copiers or things like that. It is for broadcast equipment.
And Mr. Glazer, I mean, what do, and maybe this is a better question for the Department of Administration, I don't, given the fact that you've been doing the equipment grants year after year, how does that compare with a radio station that's not part of AMPRS, an actual private radio station, and the kind of money that you're spending on equipment from a year-to-year basis? And, you know, I guess I'm surprised that it's every single year that you are doing, or every biennium, I should say, equipment grants. And I'd just be curious to know what kind of review that the department does to see if this is maybe the right way to go, or if there's a better mechanism for it. Because I'd hate to think that they get to the month of December and they've got this equipment grant money and say, well, let's buy a couple more, you know, CD players or whatever that they need just to use up the money.
Madam Chair, members, my background initially was in TV news and then radio sales and radio advertising for 14 years. And the biggest difference is these are small community radio stations. As you'll see on our handout, you're talking about a collective budget of around $8 million, as opposed to a comparison for NPR of an $88 million. I can assure you that, having done site visits myself, the Department of Administration does site visits. The money is, we are not doing any million-dollar toilets. We are not doing any last-minute, we better spend this. Typically, it's spent very quickly right out of the gate, because we are not able to use, we are not able to do advertising the way that we are licensed through the FCC. There are commercial license and non-commercial license. The commercial license stations bring in tremendous amounts of of advertising dollars. That is how they not only fund their operation, but that's how they make a profit. We are not looking to make a profit. We're looking to serve our communities, and as such, run a very, very lean budget. And as a result of that, there is failing equipment, and they are in need of replacing and updating all of our equipment. These grants are so small that they are not going out, and they're not state-of-the-art facilities. This is, I can assure you that the money is not being wasted.
Mr. Glazer, just to piggyback a little bit off of what Representative Howe was speaking to, is the goal that you said any station that wants to become a member can become a member. What kind of impact have you projected out? What does that mean for the state then as a whole? Because I'm assuming the more stations that you collect as part of your consortium, the more money that you're going to ask for from the state. Have you looked at projections for that at all, or made that consideration?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And obviously that dips into, you know, the amount of the equipment grants will get smaller and smaller as the more members that you receive into your group.
Madam Chair, we've seen unusual growth here recently. Prior to the four native stations that came on in the last 4 years and the one in Bemidji-Bagley area, there had not been a addition for over 10 years. What you're seeing right now is an influx of low-power FMs that the FCC just approved. We do not represent low-power FMs. They are not eligible for state funding because they are so small. They're not eligible for state or federal. Their trade radius or their broadcast signal is about anywhere from 2 to 5 miles. They're very, very small. So those are not a part of our group. You know, typically well in advance of any new stations that are being in the making. First, they have to get FCC approval for a build permit. There are no, to our knowledge, and we are knowledgeable as to what's going on out there, there are no build permits out there, which means that it's pretty safe to say there will be no new community publicly licensed radio stations in the next 5 to 6 years for sure, and likely well beyond that. There are a couple out there that are not currently members, like Rochester. They are not members. I don't see them becoming members because they're more of a alternative rock format, and unless they change their format dramatically, they would not be serving the community in such a way that they would be eligible for state funding, because they have to have a certain amount of local educational programming, local community programming, etc., and they're really just running music. So Rochester is probably the only one that could possibly come on. I'm not aware of any others out there in the near future that would be joining us. The others that are out there are religious in nature. They are not eligible for state funding and probably would not join us either, nor would it make sense for them to join us.
And Mr. Glazer, what's the smallest broadcast that you have of the group, distance-wise? How small?
The smallest would probably be KBFT in Net Lake. I am not exactly sure of the distance of that signal, but I'd be more than happy to get that information for you and provide it to you and your committee administrator so you can share it with the committee.
Mr. Glazer, I think that would be helpful for all of the different stations that you have. What is their broadcast range? I'm also interested in knowing what kind of listenership that each of the stations have. If you can get that information, I think that would be helpful as well.
Madam Chair, we will do our very best. I will tell you that unfortunately there are many that we are not able to provide that information for. It's not that we don't want to, and we would love to have that information. We are able to tell you, first of all, if you look at the map, and this is a very conservative map, that we cover approximately 75% of the state of Minnesota. This is a question that comes up quite regularly. The reason that we are unable to answer it is there's now one and only one company that does surveys of radio listenership. That is now Nielsen. There used to be Nielsen and Arbitron. It's just Nielsen. Nielsen does not survey many of the areas. WTIP, it used to be a diary system. It's now what's called a personal people meter. So that person has to wear what's the equivalent of a pager next to their phone, and it picks up what radio station is in the area that they happen to be listening to. So whether you're at home, in the car, in a store, whatever. Many of our stations are in areas that are not The Nielsen does not see it as financially beneficial for them to monitor those. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that we can provide in some cases is the number of listener members who contribute. Mm-hmm. But we ran that here recently for a representative, and it was very difficult. The national average is that only about 10% of the listeners actually give. But as we pulled our numbers, KMOJ and Jazz 88, for example, one was 6% and one was 8% because we are able to know their listenership. So I can certainly get that for you for the stations that I know, and that we have access to that research. But there are many situations where, unfortunately, that research just simply does not exist.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Glazer. We have Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I want to go back to the 4%, and my question really isn't for the witness, but perhaps our fiscal analyst or admin. I'm trying to recall. I think they said they had 1.5 positions dealing with the oversight of the grants. Two positions, was that? Or you held up two fingers. It's
Representative Carlson.
I thought it was 1.5, but at any rate.
1.5, but then she wasn't counting herself, so it was 2.5.
Oh, 2.5, okay. Yep. And I'm just trying to remember how much this 4% generated then. Is that just cover the actual cost, or will it be more than what it costs for those then 2.5 positions? And the other reason I raise this question, this isn't the only place in state government where there's that kind of holdback. The other one that I'm aware of is the University of Minnesota. And they get a lot of grants. There's big money there when you're dealing with all the research grants and so on, and they hold back a percentage, I forget what it is, but for central administration to cover overhead costs. And quite frankly, that's always been controversial within the university. It's been a while since I've been on the committee, but at least it was when I was on the committee a way that central administration handled it. But there was always kind of a tug of war. Some of the profs would sort of quietly say, you know, gee, I'm having to give whatever that percentage is for central administration overhead, and then their argument was somewhat what we heard from admin yesterday. I don't know if there's better ways to fund this. If you're required to do it, it isn't built into your budget, so that would be a 4% reduction in the case of AMPRS. But at any rate, maybe Ms. Roberts knows, or was that pretty much a wash in terms of that 4% providing for the cost of those 2.5 positions, or would there be a net gain for admin?
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, just to clarify, so the 4% is not something that's being charged now, and in fact, I think the administration would have to ask for some law change to be able to do that. And they are saying up to 4%, so it's possible that the public broadcasting grants would be charged something less than 4%. And those are the only grants right now that are general fund mm-hmm. grants that are flowing through administration. But if the 4%, a full 4% was charged on the base numbers for public broadcasting, that would be about $209,000 for the biennium for an increase to Department of Administration. Where I think it might be helpful to get some clarity is on what the exact role of the Office of Grants Management is in terms of hands-on oversight of these grants versus more strategic management of all of state grants. They don't administer all of the state grants, but they do set policy for other agencies that make grants. And I believe that there may be other offices within the Department of Administration that provide support to the direct oversight of the grant making, but I think we'd probably benefit from some clarification.
And Madam Chair, being that it is new, maybe that's a good suggestion from Ms. Roberts to perhaps learn a bit more about how those numbers net out.
Go ahead.
But it has always been an internal debate, at least when I was on the committee with the U of M, and I don't know if Minsky does the same kind of thing or not. They obviously don't have as many research grants as the U of M, but they do have some, so I don't know what their policies are in that regard either. But there may be other places in state government where that might surface, but I'm mainly interested in this committee and what that 4% really means in terms of how it covers those costs.
Well, that was one of the questions when we had admin here yesterday asking, you know, what is their overall budget and what do they plan to do? Yesterday, at least, they didn't seem to have a clear idea of what their budget was, except that they did plan to charge a different rate depending upon the level of service or interaction that they had with each of the grants. But I do think it begs the question of, well, how much then will it be? They currently are charging back to legacy grants, but this would be new for all the other items. And I do believe that DEED does a similar chargeback situation for all of the things that they do as well. So I think that we will have a hearing just to that effect to see what their overall plan is, if they've already charged some of these entities, if it is truly new just to this area and what that all means. So good suggestion and look forward to having it here. And
Madam Chair, that's all basically I'm asking for is just maybe a little bit more information. Thank you.
We'll have it on the docket. So we've got lots of members. Representative Detmer to this point.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and just brought back a conversation I had with an organization that did receive a grant, I think, 4 years ago, and it was administered through the Department of Administration. It was a disabled veterans camp, and they received the grant. They weren't aware of the charge that was charged, so they ended up being short mm-hmm. on the funds that they had really planned on using for their project. So that was something that I just thought I'd bring up.
Well, admin is here, so that's going to be one of the questions that will be asked of you when we have a separate hearing to talk about this entire issue. We have Representative Albright Johnson and Runbeck. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Mr. Glazer. So for about the past 10 years, when I get in my truck, I don't listen to FM. I listen to XM. And when I go up by Ely, or I happen to go visit a good friend of mine in Rosso, which is in Kitson County, I listen to FM, or XM, because the FM up there is sparse. So in light of the communication for emergency services, that type of thing, when folks are in their cars, or as it would pertain to in their workplace or in their homes, is AMPRS ability to cut into that XM transmission for the purposes of providing emergency details about imminent weather, that type of thing? What contingency for people that are more and more reliant upon that type of media, what contingency are you planning for in that regard?
Mr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, it is my understanding, I would need to double check, I am not aware of any station nationwide that has the ability of breaking into XM. From my understanding, the FCC requirements of emergency alert, I do not believe that applies to XM. But to your point, another issue that has been raised, I've had people say, you know, nobody listens to the radio anymore. And if you think about it, A-Track was going to kill the radio. CDs were going to kill the radio. Satellite radio was going to kill the radio. I don't have it with me, but interestingly, there was a study out just a few weeks ago showing that terrestrial radio, which is now what you refer to as traditional radio, is actually at an all-time high. More people are listening to terrestrial radio than ever before, and I want to say it was in the neighborhood of about 92% of Americans are consumers of terrestrial radio. But I do not believe the technology exists currently, because that is satellite versus we are sending it out on terrestrial towers, and there would have to be a major overhaul nationwide, federal, on a federal level, in order to mandate that they take it from this. And I don't even know, because that's the nationwide signal. I don't even know if the technology would exist to allow it just to pick up that particular area.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a follow-up then, you have the towers and you have the electronic or the gadgetry to transmit it off a tower. What would prevent you from installing the technology to send it to a satellite, your own signal from an FM, and actually transfer over from just AM/FM to XM as well? Is there consideration of that methodology as well?
Mr. Glaser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, this is the first that this has ever been raised. I can only speak to the knowledge that I have, that I used to work in satellite news gathering. The way that satellite works, it goes from one point, but it's a satellite transmission rather than a radio over the air terrestrial signal. They're two very different signals. So we would have to have a new, or anybody who is sending out the emergency alert would have to have a satellite transmitter, and then that would have to go up to the XM, and that would then go down. You wouldn't need a special receiver, but we would need a special receiver to go up, and then. But the flaw or the challenge that I'm seeing is knowing that how that works, because you're hearing XM, whether you're in California or New York, it's still the same XM because it's off of the satellite that's going nationwide. So I don't know that the technology would exist for it to come down. You obviously don't want to hear every tornado warning in Minnesota if you're listening in Texas or Louisiana, and I don't believe there would be the ability to narrow it down from my understanding currently.
Thank you, Mr. Glaser.
We have, you have further follow-ups, Representative Albright?
No, I'm thoroughly convinced.
We have Representative Johnson and Representative Rumbeck on the list, and then after that we'll go to the Campaign Finance Board to finish up. So, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Glaser, you answered most of my questions. One question I did have, I listened to my local amper station off my cell phone through my broadband connection. Is that going on with other amper stations then as well then?
Mr. Glaser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the stations all put things out on a stream. So you can stream, which in most cases means that they can also be picked up on a smartphone. So we are streaming. There's also an app. There's an Ampers app that it's a smart app, actually. So if you are driving around from location to location in a different area and you are on that app, it will pick up what station is in your area and will default to that. You can then change it. So if you're traveling up north and you really want to listen to KMOJ instead, you still have the ability to change it over to KMOJ, but it will know that you're in the area of KSRQ in Thief River or KXE in Grand Rapids, and it will default to that. So you can stream it on your phone or at ampers.org. All the stations have the ability, so not only nationwide but worldwide, you do have the opportunity to listen to these stations.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Glaser, in living where I do up in the northern part of Anoka County, If there was a group of us that wanted to start a radio station, and if there were licenses available, would it be possible to do that? And what would be the process?
Yeah. Good. Mr. Glaser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbeck, we are open to any new station that meets the... we're open to any station, first of all, because we exist to support them. We do not discriminate on any station joining us on the basis of finance or we initially, several stations have joined us before they were eligible for state funding, because we also do group underwriting, grants, things like that. You definitely could do that. finding a license from the FCC is quite a challenge. There's not a lot of bandwidth left in the state of Minnesota. It's pretty much taken. There's not, but you'd have to get a build permit. The bigger challenge there is that the federal government used to have what was called FTTP grants. I don't remember exactly what they stand for, but it was really the seed money to get it started. Those no longer exist, so it's very hard to find the financing. I had a senator yesterday ask me how much it costs. I still need to find that out, but I can tell you it's a very costly endeavor to build the station, which is a big part of why you're probably not seeing any new ones, and there are no build permits on the horizon.
Great. Thank you very much.
Representative Rumley.
That's fine.
Well, Mr. Glazier, thank you for the update and the going through the budget request, and we appreciate that. And now we'll bring up the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, and Representatives. Thank you for support.
Good morning. If you could, looks like we're going to have a multimedia event here. So, Director Goldsmith, if you could introduce yourself and to the committee and begin the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. My role this morning is really going to be to answer questions about background on our budget and about what we're doing now and what we plan for the future. I brought with me Mr. Jeff Sigurdson, who's the Assistant Executive Director, and he will talk to you about the budget proposal for this year. So with the Chair's permission, I'll turn it over to Mr. Sigurdsson.
Go ahead and state your name and your position, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. As elected officials, I believe you're aware in one way or another of the three primary functions of the board. We do the registration of all state-level candidates, political parties, and political committees and funds. There are about 700 candidates, 300 political party units, and 400 political committees and funds registered with us. They submit about 6,000 reports per election year. We also monitor and distribute about $2.3 million in public subsidy payments to you on an election year. We do the registration and reporting for about 1,300 lobbyists. In fact, just yesterday was the reporting period for the principals, which are the associations which engage in lobbying. And they reported that they spent $63 million in lobbying efforts in 2014 in Minnesota. And then our third program that we administer, our third primary program, is the Economic Interest Statement Program, where, again, all public officials, and there's about 2,400 public officials, file statements of their potential economic interests and how that may reflect on the decisions that they make for the public. And, in fact, in your mail yesterday or perhaps today, you should be receiving your letter with username and password so you can review your economic interest statement by the annual reporting date of April 15th. Looking back a little bit on background in the budget before we get to the current request, in 2000 and the biennium for 2012-13, the budget for the board was $689,000, which allowed the board to have a staff of 7.6. At that point, the board was falling back and was not keeping up with investigations and complaints filed with the board. And we were also not able to move forward on a lot of the initiatives that we wanted to do in terms of projects to improve the board's ability to provide disclosure to the public. So at that point, for the current biennium 14-15, the board asked for a significant increase to a $1 million budget, with the understanding that that would be used to increase staff, but also to dedicate approximately $130,000 per year of each year of the budget for IT-type projects that include primarily the web-based activities, but also other projects related to the board. And that was granted, and our current budget is $1 million per year. At that time, we also said that basically that would be sufficient for this biennium, which is, again, the increase or the budget that the board requested was a flat $1 million per year. The governor did add to that the 1.8% increase to the compensation package or in anticipation of increases that will be made across the board for all state employees. But other than that, the $1 million is a flat line from our current biennium into the next biennium. One other issue that you should be aware of, as I mentioned, there was, when the budget was set up for the last biennium, the promise that we would try to spend about $130,000 per year on IT projects. The first year of our current biennium was basically the election year, and we were, staff was tied down with looking into complaints and issues related to that election, and we're not really able to get off to the flying start on some of the IT projects that we wanted to at that point. We currently have a developer who is re-engineering, you might say, our databases so that we'll better be able to support interactive searches on the new website. We also have a project out that's with a contractor who's developing online training so that those treasurers who are in greater Minnesota and find it difficult to come to St. Paul for the type of training that we provide in compliance and reporting, we'll be able to go to their computer and at any time that's convenient for them, look at online training so that they're better able to comply with the provisions of Chapter 10A. Those projects are undergoing. We're also getting ready to do some website development contracts before this biennium is over. Nonetheless, there is approximately $150,000 from the current biennium's budget that we have not been able to use effectively on our website development and other electronic, other IT-related projects. And we are requesting a one-time ability to move that money from the current biennium into the next biennium so that we can add it with those funds and continue to develop our website and have it in place for the 2016 election cycle. That is going to be through one of two different ways. There is a MMB change order that would allow all state agencies to carry forward unused funds from the current biennium into the next biennium and go forward with that. The board has no policy position on that suggestion, but administratively, of course, it would accomplish the same thing. The other alternative, if that provision doesn't go forward, is I believe Representative Nash has agreed to carry a bill that will allow the board to carry on a one-time basis $150,000 from the current biennium into the next biennium dedicated for website development. And that's a quick overview, and of course we are available for questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. and I'm going to butcher this, Sigurdsson. My question, when it comes to training, you've got the online piece and you got the training that goes on down here. Do you also do outstate training and at sites outside the metro area? Because I will tell you that in where I live, and I'm just a one little pocket, I don't get good internet. I really struggle to do online training. In fact, when I ask for help, and we try to get help from your great folks that provide a great assistance, I will tell you that, when I was struggling with the program and getting things straight, they provided great assistance, but they became fully aware of my struggle with having data links or whatever you want, internet. My internet connection falters, and it's not great. So do you do outstate training where we can attend, or is it all down here in St. Paul?
Mr. Chair, we do offer training in greater Minnesota. Typically, Mr. Goldsmith does that, sort of the executive director's tour. It typically happens during the year prior to an election year, simply because during an election year there are so many investigations and other actions that the board are taking related directly to the election. It's very difficult for him to be out of the office for any length of time. I have also in the past done some training sessions in greater Minnesota, but admittedly those are still going to be based on, I think, as I recall, 7 or 8 different training sites around the state. And of course that still means, is it going to be convenient on that particular day for any individual treasurer? So I believe we're going to certainly continue in-person training in greater Minnesota. But hopefully your internet access improves, because I think in the long run, the way to really address the issue for so many people is to be able to provide it 24/7 so it's convenient to their schedule.
I appreciate that, Mr. Sigurdsson. But as we go forward, and I'm glad we're working on a new program, because I have yet to find a treasurer that likes the current method of or the current program.
How many treasurers do you go through?
You know, and I'm relatively young in this process, and as far as being down here, and I'm yeah, that's a struggle for me. They they don't like beating their head against the wall. As you go through this, do you use Minute to try? Have you used or talked to Minute about trying to get to this new program, or are you doing all outsource?
Mr. Chair and members, I'll take that question because I am the agency liaison with Minute, and Minute offers limited services to state agencies, including those executive branch agencies that are part of consolidation. And based on testimony that I listened to from this committee from last week, apparently even a more limited version of services for an agency like ours. We do use Minute for those things that they provide for everybody, like website hosting currently, web access, telecommunications, email, and so on. Minute Services does not, to my knowledge, provide custom programming for any agency, even the branch agencies. If custom programming is done, it's done by those agency employees who are now Minute employees but were previously agency employees. Even an executive branch agency that wants to contract for website development outside of Minute's template development for the new Tridian system would have to go to an outside program. We have a contract with Minute to have them develop those pages for our new website that can be hosted on the Tridian system, but unknown to many people except those people who have to do it, the Minute web hosting system does not host interactive data. And by interactive data, I mean truly interactive data. That is web pages that access a database to return pages based on that data. So graphs of campaign spending, comparison charts of campaign spending, even economic interest statements or lobbyist reports that are generated on the spot from data in a database. The Minute servers do not host that kind of data because they do not support what is called server-side code, where the server would get a query and translate it through data and send a page back. So almost every state agency that has that kind of service, and that's very many state agencies, host their own servers, and we do that as well. And Minute Services doesn't provide the pages to do that. So when Mr. Sigurdsson says that we're bringing on a website developer, that will be the person who will develop those pages that will access data from our database and display that through our website, part of which will be hosted by Minute and part of it which will have to be hosted internally because they're not set up to do that. So to the extent we can, we use Minute, and to the extent we can't, we use contracting processes that Minute and Admin have set up to allow us to hire outside people.
Thank you, Mr. Goldstein.
Goldsmith. On this.
To this point?
Yes.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and witnesses, as I understand it, the Minute employees in your agency are still Minute employees. They're, you know, that was specifically the model that we did. They're in the Minute budget. But those people ought to be the people who are doing this. But the person that you're looking at hiring, is that person not to be a Minute employee or what?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, first of all, one clarification. Back when consolidation took place, I met with members on this committee. I think I probably met with you, Representative Kahn.
And it was more than a week ago. You don't expect me to remember.
It's a long time ago. And I only remember myself because the result of that was that the Campaign Finance Board was exempted from consolidation. And the reason for that at the time was because we didn't exactly understand what consolidation would be. And the board was concerned that the governor's office, which controls Minute Services as a cabinet-level agency, might ultimately end up having some control over the level of IT staffing that the board could have, and so we were exempted. Now, it appears now that that may not have been the case. Maybe an agency can buy whatever staff it wants for Minute. I don't know the answer to that. So first of all, our two IT staff are not Minute staff. They're board staff, and they have full-time jobs. One of them develops and supports the campaign finance reporter software. The other provides internal support for our databases. As you might know, the Campaign Finance Board is a data-driven agency. Everything that we do internally in the staff workload is data. And so those two people are fully involved, although one of the IT staff is working on the next version of Campaign Finance Reporter. Initially, that will be a lightweight version that will be an online-based system, and it's in development now, will be an online-based system for small committees who don't use the full software. It's not warranted that they learn that, to simply go online and fill out a form online, but that will be data rather than PDF. And then that will expand to the full online version, so you will no longer need to use the software that resides on your computer.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn.
I thought I had heard you say earlier that they were Minute employees, so that's why I followed through.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I apologize for that. I was talking about employees in other agencies who I believe are Minute employees do that programming, and to the extent we do it, our employees do it, but developing a new website is beyond the workload that they can take on.
And members, I apologize for kind of hogging the conversation. It just so happens that I get to sit at the gavel when this thing comes up, and this is really something down my lane that I'm really interested in. So I'm going to ask two more questions, and we'll go to y'all. So Mike, I'm going to change the discussion. When you say most of your stuff is data driven. When you see that we have a violation, I guess I'm concerned with the amount of teeth that you have, and I'm going to just try to get all my questions into one because I'm concerned with the lack of teeth that you have, and explain the teeth that you do have, your amount of effort that you can enforce something, and if there's a lack of compliance, what happens to that individual? And My what I'm looking for is maybe a more effective way of doing that, maybe taking it out of campaign finance and going to administrative, office of administrative hearings. And so can you expound on exactly how that process works and maybe what enforcement techniques you do have?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The board has a couple of approaches. First of all, when we get reports in, we run computer routines to identify violations so that we don't have to look at them manually. If there's a violation, it's based on statute, and the statute typically is going to specify the penalty. Unlike some agencies, the board does not have any overriding general ability to impose a financial penalty. Each financial penalty is specified in the particular statute that creates the violation. In many cases, the penalty is a financial penalty of up to four times the amount of the violation. In some cases, it's capped at $3,000. It just varies on what the legislature has provided. Last year, the legislature passed some changes to the board's investigation and enforcement processes. They originated in the other body, but ultimately were in the conference committee report, were adopted by the legislature. And the thrust of those changes was to change the board's approach somewhat, particularly to the investigation of complaints. Whereas the statute previously said the board must investigate every complaint, and so we really took that as a directive that we had to do that. The new language sets forth a two-step process before we get to the investigation. First is the preliminary determination as to whether the document actually states a complaint. That's something that was done before and is fairly straightforward. The next step is a probable cause determination where the board looks at the complaint and decides whether there's a violation or not. If there is, which there usually is by that stage, then the board decides whether to investigate or not and whether to impose sanctions or not. And in a lot of cases now where either where there's no penalty, for example, there is no penalty for making a mistake on a campaign finance report unless you fail to remedy the mistake after you've been given notice by the board. So in those cases, if there's been an amendment to correct the mistake and there's no civil penalty available, the matter gets dismissed at the probable cause stage. Otherwise, it goes to investigation, which is a formal process. We also have a staff review, which is an informal form of investigation. It seems to me that the board has sufficient tools available, at least in most cases, to enforce and ensure compliance with Chapter 10A. What we find actually is that almost every violation is inadvertent or accidental, and not so much accidental as caused in some cases by treasurer procrastination. So they don't put a transaction into the campaign finance software in time to be notified of a violation when they can still fix it. On contributions, you have 90 days to return a contribution to avoid a violation that might have occurred. At least two spending limits violations this year. One is very small, about $50, and one is somewhat more. But if the treasurer had been using the software regularly, they would be getting warnings as they approach their spending limit. Some of these are attributed to campaign workers spending money when they weren't supposed to be or didn't notify the treasurer. These relate to internal controls. But in the end, we don't see actual intentional violations of campaign finance laws. And for that reason, we feel that the sanctions that are available are appropriate. One of the things we're doing much more frequently now is entering into an agreement where part of the penalty will be stayed conditioned on not having a future violation. There are often other terms and conditions, such as doing data entry every 60 days or verifying certain things back to the board on a regular basis. I'm not sure that sending it off to the Office of Administrative Hearings would achieve any different result. If there are specific things that members think need stronger enforcement or need tweaking, we'd be happy to know about those. But I think that for the type of violations and the intent that's involved, we're adequately provided with tools at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. But my question is that you didn't answer is, what happens if the candidate or the political entity just decides, or the campaign funds just decides not to comply? What rules, what do you have in your toolbox for that situation?
Mr. Chair and members, the final tool that we have, and we do use it, is litigation. I have a matter out to the Attorney General's office, who provides our legal services right now, regarding a candidate who failed to file a report, and we will get a court order to compel that candidate to file a report, and then, if necessary, enforce that court order.
So, and therein lies my concern, where you've got someone that's now politically, one way or the other, choosing to, as your legal resource, and I guess that's one of my concerns, is you got to go to the Attorney General, and the Attorney General belongs to one party or the other. May be inclined to do this or may be inclined to do something other than that, and that's where I guess I'd like to see it go to a different avenue other than this avenue. But I'll we can take that up on another discussion. We'll go to the questions. Chair Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sigurdsson, my biggest concern is how many different versions that you have done for the campaign reporter software, and what kind of input in development of that. You said you're in the process of developing a new version of that. You've got the light version that you're developing, but it sounds like you're doing another new version of the campaign reporter. What kind of efforts do you make to reach out to the treasurers that actually fill out the, enter in the data into the campaign finance reporter?
Madam Chair, a little background to, and then to directly to your question. The current version of Campaign Finance Reporter was developed in 1998, and obviously things have changed pretty dramatically since then in terms of what's available for support. And one issue that has always been an issue, and I believe Representative Kahn, if she was here, would probably second, is that it is not particularly compatible with any Apple-based computers. So one direction that we're going here with the online development of the software is that, of course, it won't matter what sort of PC you're running it on, and so those issues go away. In terms of development, the first step, of course, is to make sure that it's accurate in reporting the information that's required through statute for the report, and then built onto that, in our case, in increments, is the compliance checking, where we check, as Mr. Goldsmith mentioned, both the incoming contributions to the committee and the expenditures that they're making. It is true that we have not started a group to review of treasurers to review the new version. I think that's primarily because we're simply not that far down the road. But we have developed an interested group who are going to give us feedback on our website development. And I don't think it would be much of an effort to then expand that or to approach a group of treasurers to make sure that we are, in fact, providing them with a tool that they're going to be able to use. And we have always in the past had interested treasurers look at our software to make sure that we are in fact doing something that is useful to them, and I think we'll make it more formal here as we have such a major shift in the way that we provide that service to the communities.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Sigurdsson. I would strongly encourage you to get that kind of feedback, because I have to tell you, as a user of Campaign Finance Reporter and somebody that I would consider to be pretty tech savvy, it is counterintuitive to what you actually need to do, how it's labeled, what you need to file. For someone who has been filling out campaign finance reports for my own campaign and for other candidates for years, it is not a helpful tool. And given the fact that it's been since 1998 that you guys have been doing it, I would really strongly encourage you to get that kind of feedback, because I think it would be a better product. It would make sure that people are in compliance, which I know that's the great thing about the Campaign Finance Board, is you guys are about helping people to be compliant with the law. And I just think by having greater feedback on this, that will make sure that we're achieving the goal that the agency has set out.
Mr. Goldsmith?
Just one further comment on that, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. That is a very big hindrance that the software was developed so long ago, and it was updated in the year 2000, but only to update some of the background technologies and to make it work on Windows products that existed then. And one of the biggest problems you'll see is the size of the screen that you have to work with, because back when it was developed, screen resolution was 640 by 480, and that picture that you look at now filled the whole screen, and so it was a lot easier to read, but still it was crowded. Now with high resolution screens, we would have room to expand things, to put better explanations in it, and we recognize it looks like and is 1998 technology, and the new version will be web-based, and it will look and feel like a 21st century technology.
Terrific. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, first of all, I just want to say that I agree with you. I don't think anyone has intentionally decided to go against this. We all want to be participate of that. And just to your staff as well, I have called a few times and had my treasurer call a few times, and you've always responded very quickly and proficiently, and so I thank you for that, because I don't believe you want to be in the enforcement either as well. So just to say thank you for that. But I will re-echo what Representative Anderson said, and that is that I have used it quite a lot myself, and it is quite, this isn't official words, but it's quite clunky, and it is not intuitive at all in direction there, and unless you have the book next to you of the directions, and even then it's difficult to do. So whatever you can do to make that more intuitive to today's design and language is better, and I just commend you to keep trying that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of comments. One for you, by the way, when Representative Kahn asked you how many treasurers you had, it jarred my memory a little bit. And my first treasurer was with me for 2 years, then she moved out of the area. So my next treasurer was with me for 26 years, and then he retired, both from his occupation as well as my treasurer. And my current treasurer has been with me for 15 years. My point is, when you get a good treasurer, be sure you keep them. And then my assistant treasurer has been with me for 43 years, but that happens to be my wife. At any rate, just keep a good treasurer. That's advice to everyone, I guess. But I do have an interest in paperwork. And by the way, I'll start my comments by... I'll follow up the comments about having had a good experience when we call the office. You folks are very prompt and very helpful, so I want to thank you officially for that. But my first question deals with the economic interest form. Are we still in an election year required to fill out two forms as we move into next year's election?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, that is the way it still works. That's the way the legislation is written. One of the goals of the board is to periodically review programs overall. In the last couple of years, it's been the campaign finance program, and you've seen significant legislative recommendations to improve and streamline that program where we can. We're well aware that we need to do the same thing with the economic interest program so that both we understand and you understand what you are requiring of yourselves and others, and I think that's an issue that we need to address.
And Mr. Chairman, I would hope at some point you have a housekeeping bill. What I'm referring to there is, in fact, you just commented that we just received in the mail, I think mine must have come yesterday, for the new economic interest form. Well, that's not the issue I'm raising isn't this year. It's in an election year where you fill it out in for April, and then you follow it up when you file for office in May. And I just checked, and it's about May 22nd now. I think a bit of unnecessary paperwork for incumbents, at least. I think one date or the other should probably be picked with an update piece of legislation just to change that. I have actually thought that should have been done when we had the September primary, because you're filing for office then in July, and you've just filled out the economic interest form in April. So maybe that's something the board can think about with a housekeeping bill, just to reduce the paperwork. My other question is, if you invest in this also deals with the economic interest form, but if you invest in a mutual fund or deferred comp, way back when the board was first formed and we had to do economic interest forms, I just listed the company I had investments in. And then they were helpful but said, well, you have to break that out in terms of where that mutual fund or deferred comp, if you happen to participate, like in the state deferred comp, where those investments are held. And I've always kind of felt that was a bit meaningless. It's not something that the investor really controls. You know, you, in the case of those of us that are participating in deferred comp with the state, which I have for many years, you they deduct it from your check, and you're not really moving the money around in a way in which there would ever be a conflict. I'm just thinking at the list. I think for me it ends up being about 60 different investments. Some of them are truly separate investments, but some of them are breaking out things like mutual fund and so on, and just a suggestion to maybe take a look at that, and it would shorten the form. I think that's the only time I recall where I had to do a correction, because and this probably goes back to the 1970s when I just listed the name of the company, but have done that ever since. And so then I call the mutual fund company and double check every April and say, okay, where are those investments being held? And then often there's very little or no change, but sometimes there is. It's just a bit of extra burden that I'm not sure is really that necessary in terms of disclosure, being that we don't really control the money per se. Just another thing to suggest that you'd perhaps take a look at. But having said that, you know, I again just want to compliment you on the promptness in getting back. So thank you.
Mr. Goldsmith.
I agree with Representative Carlson's opinions. It's the whole idea of what has to be disclosed is a concern. And it's even more of a concern for people like Soil and Water Conservation District managers and watershed management organization people, whose votes on things that they're dealing with probably can never affect a stock that's traded on the New York Stock Exchange, and yet they have to disclose those because of the idea that there might be a conflict of interest. So that will be certainly part of our review.
Well, I appreciate your comments here, and I greatly appreciate your helpful staff. They've helped me navigate that numerous times, myself and my treasurer. So, but with that, we appreciate that, and the meeting is adjourned.